CITR 101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast.
Now here's your host, Brad Pepping.
Good evening. Brad Pepping is taking a well-deserved study break. I'm Megan Turcato, and I'll be your host tonight. In the news tonight, it has been 20 years since the Montreal Massacre. In recognition of the International Day of Action on Violence Against Women, we bring you a community radio coverage first broadcast in 1989, which provides feminist analysis of that tragic event. The International Climate Change Conference opened today in Copenhagen, Denmark. We hear a podcast put together by Canadian youth delegates to the talks. We'll have all this, plus sports and your weekday weather forecast, coming up this half hour, right here on News 101. Today marks the beginning of the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference. A group of Canadian students are in Copenhagen to follow the talks, and will be providing a daily podcast, updating Canada as negotiations progress. We have their first podcast, tonight, providing us with background on climate change.
You're listening to a podcast from the Canadian Youth Delegation to Copenhagen for the UN climate change negotiations.
Our country's identity is changing.
I think we do have a big role.
It's time to act now. It's for your children.
Who is going to do it?
Seal the deal on Copenhagen.
Welcome to the first CYD podcast. The Canadian Youth Delegation to Copenhagen is a group of 35 young Canadians from across the country who are attending the UN Conference on Climate Change, known as COP15, which will be starting on the 7th of December, which is tomorrow for us right now. We'll be podcasting daily from the talks, and we'll have updates on the negotiations, climate change policy backgrounders, and a lot more. The Canadian Youth Delegation's daily news from the UN Climate Negotiations.
Hello, my name is Anne. I'm from Denmark, Copenhagen.
Hey there, my name is Holly Jones. I'm from the United States.
Hello, I'm Dipesh from Nepal.
Hi everyone, my name is Sophia and my Chinese name is Lai Jun and I come from Taiwan.
Hello, my name is Karthikay Singh and I am from India.
My name is Jonathan, I'm from Sweden.
My name is Kalam Kisundas, I'm from South Africa.
My name is Ahmed Adchan, I'm from Maldives. We are the most vulnerable country in the Maldives.
In preparation for the beginning of negotiations tomorrow, young people from around the world gathered in Copenhagen at the Conference of Youth to plan for the climate conference. We've got Dean and Aidan here to give you the scoop.
I'm the Manitoba delegate of the Canadian Youth Delegation, and I'm here with Aidan.
I'm Aidan Abram. I'm with the Youth Constituency. I'm a staff member, community builder is my title. I'm from Canada as well, from Guelph, Ontario.
I understand that you're helping organize COI.
Yeah, we've had a team come together. It's our fifth conference of youth, fifth in a row, beginning back in Montreal in 2005. And it really has two objectives. The first objective is to get young people to come together and prepare for being effective at the Conference of Parties. And the other one is sort of building skills beyond COP. COP is just one event out of many. It's only one event out of a year's worth of activities. And, you know, we're going to come back for a COP16 and a COP17, as well as people need to go back to their own homes, their own countries, and continue this work. So it's all about skill building and creating, you know, greater networks and greater opportunities because we're in this to win.
Right. And so how many volunteers have been helping you out?
The core team has been, give or take, 12 people.
And how about at the conference? How many people are here at the conference and from how many nations?
So we have about 500 youth who are attending the Conference of Youth, which is a fantastic number. Last year was about 260. And we're estimating, well, we haven't had a confirmation, about 80 countries are represented here. We're anticipating more than 100 countries to be represented by young people at the Conference of Parties. So we're nearly there.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Climate change policy. I'm here with Caroline Lee, who's going to explain to us some of the background behind the UN Climate Conference. So do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Caroline Lee, and I'm a student in Vancouver.
What is a COP?
The COP stands for the Conference of Parties. This means that all of the parties that have signed on to a convention called the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, they have a meeting every year. This meeting is called the Conference of Parties. This conference is called COP15 because it is the 15th meeting of this kind.
And so if this convention
been around for 15 years. What are we doing about it today?
That is a good question. When it first got signed, it basically said that countries would voluntarily try to address climate change somehow, but it didn't say exactly how. Since then, we have given countries legal commitments. We have also explained more specifically how developed countries can help finance adaptation and other help for developing countries that need it.
How does the Kyoto Protocol fit into all this?
The Kyoto Protocol made it such that industrialized countries were legally bound to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions.
And by when were we aiming to do this?
It was 2008 to 2012, so we are now in that time span.
Okay, and so what happens after 2012?
That is what we are trying to negotiate here. So the first commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol expires in 2012. And so countries are here trying to decide what we are going to do once that commitment period expires.
So tomorrow's the first day of the conference, December 7th, and it's probably today for our listeners. And so what do we expect is going to be happening?
There aren't going to be substantial negotiations taking place. It's just going to be mainly the opening remarks.
Thanks a lot, Caroline.
This has been a podcast from the Canadian Youth Delegation to Copenhagen for the UN climate change negotiations. Hear more on iTunes or at cydcopenhagen.org.
That's right. You can check out their podcast daily at cydcopenhagen.org or tune in to News 101 next Friday to hear an update from the Canadian Youth Delegation as they follow these talks intently. It's time for a quick break, but up next we'll bring you coverage of International Day of Action on Violence Against Women.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the helpline is one of many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The helpline number is 604-696-4666 or contact us online at www.aidsvancouver.org.
Concerned about the impact the Olympic Games could have on civil liberties?
The BC Civil Liberties Association is training UBC students to act as legal observers during the Games.
Observers will report observations back to the BCCLA's team of lawyers who are prepared to go to court to protect people's rights where complaints can't be resolved informally.
Focusing on accountable conduct in interactions between civilians and police, the observers' firsthand evidence will form a solid foundation for those legal actions.
If you are interested in participating, come to Legal Observer Training on Thursday, December 10th at noon in the sub in room 212.
Space is limited.
To register, email stephanie@bccla.org.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
You're listening to News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at UBC. Thanks for being with us tonight. It's been 20 years since the shooting deaths of 14 female engineering students at Montreal's École Polytechnique. Tonight we bring you coverage originally aired in 1989 on the still-running community radio program WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service. They take a look at this tragic event from a feminist perspective.
There were men and women inside the classroom. He asked or ordered the men to walk out of the classroom. Then he gathered the women in one side of the classroom and then shot six women there. He then went on the first floor into the cafeteria.
On December 6th, 1989, a gunman claiming his life had been ruined by feminists killed 14 women in the École Polytechnique, the University of Montreal's engineering school, and then shot himself. The 14 victims were Genevieve Bergeron, age 21, Hélène Colgan, age 23, Nathalie Croteau, 23, Barbara Daigneault, 22, Anne-Marie Edward, 20, Maud Haviernik, 29, Barbara Maria Kluesnik, 31, Maryse Lagagnère, 25, Maryse Leclerc, 23, Anne-Marie Lemay, 27, Sonia Pelletier, 28, Michel Richard, 21, Annie Saint-Arnaud, 23, and Annie Turcotte, 21. Marc Lepine, who was born Gamel Garbi in Algeria to an Algerian father and a Quebecois mother, came to Canada with his family at the age of 7. His father was abusive and violent toward him, his mother, and sister, and his parents were eventually divorced. He later adopted his mother's maiden name. As Lepine walked calmly through 3 floors of the engineering building shooting at women, he shouted, "I hate feminists, I want the women, and if I can't be an engineer, neither can you." Police later revealed that Lepine had previously applied to the engineering school. The Concordia University Women's Union, along with the Université de Montréal Student Union, organized a candlelight vigil the evening after the shootings. Beth Blackmore of Radio Centreville's Matrix Collective was there.
Police estimated that there were 5,000 marchers carrying candles in the twilight, but media estimates were as high as 10,000. The march stopped outside the engineering school, where there was some tension for a few minutes when the first speaker, a woman from Concordia, a primarily Anglophone university, addressed the mostly French-speaking crowd in English. Then, when feminists tried to read a statement, they were stopped by a man from the U of M Student Union, who, in turn, was shouted at when he referred to those who had died using the masculine pronoun se instead of the feminine celle. Emotions were rising, but when another woman, also a U of M student from the Commerce Department, came out of the crowd to the megaphone and pleaded for unity, people put aside their differences and continued the vigil in silence, marching to St. Joseph's Oratory for a silent meditation. In minus 20 degree weather, people needed to get indoors, but some Anglophone feminists preferred not to go to a church. The vigil ended after about half an hour in the oratory, with participants placing their candles on the altar before leaving.
Immediate public reaction was also, for the most part, split along gender lines. Most men, including journalists and politicians, said that this was an isolated act by a deranged personality. Most women expressed the belief that the killings were the result of society's tolerance of violence against women taken to the extreme. During the following days, however, the public, the media, and the politicians began to understand the feminist position. Gazette reporter Mary Lamy.
There was a large news meeting. Everyone who was available, all of the senior editors were there, and one of the senior editors said, the feminists are being very strident about this, which is always what they say when they don't like what we feminists have to say, and making accusations about misogyny and woman-hating and culture, and our culture. And I think we need to look into that and disprove it, if because that's quite an allegation. And I said, well, I have a lot of connections in the women's community. I think I could look into that if you like. Because originally I was slated to chase families, the families of the deceased, and get photos and stuff like that, which is just the most distasteful thing. And so I managed to get this job of phoning feminist communities across the country and spokespersons to find out the feminist analysis. I felt quite fortunate that I work in a mainstream paper that may not have believed may not believe that misogyny exists, but was willing to look into it a bit because so many people were talking about it. I was very excited and very nervous and very agitated, but quite determined to be logical and level-headed and to write a story and get interviews and get quotes that were really, really solid so that it wouldn't sound like a bunch of crackpot women, blowing off steam. I talked to women who were very articulate and intelligent and logical and wrote very articulate and intelligent and logical feminist analysis. Well, I didn't write, it wasn't because I was so brilliant. It was because I talked to people who were really, really good. And that ran on the front page of the weekly review of the Saturday paper. 250,000 Gazette readers got to read a feminist analysis of the shooting.
Women in Montreal felt devastated by these events and expressed their anger, frustration, and grief both publicly and privately. Women engineers were asked to wear white scarves on December 11th, the day of the public funeral for 10 of the victims. At a pro-choice rally held the day before, women attending were asked to wear pink armbands on December 11th to express solidarity with the women who died and with the feminist movement. Some Montreal feminists organized a women-only memorial held on December 13th, at which representatives of women's groups and individual women were invited to come up to the mic and express their feelings or read messages of solidarity. Women outside Montreal were also shocked and saddened by the killings. Women's groups in many cities held memorial services to honor the young women who died. Some women expressed the hope that this occurrence would not make us afraid to declare ourselves as feminists, but on the contrary, would serve to bring us together and strengthen our determination to continue this struggle. Reporting for Wings, this is Laura Yaros and Beth Blackmore in Montreal.
News Gathering Services coverage of the Montreal Massacre, originally broadcast in 1989. In response to this tragic crime, the Canadian Parliament declared December 6th the National Day of Action and Remembrance on Violence Against Women in Canada. In the spirit of this holiday, we bring you a speech from Dr. Laurie Haskell on why violence against women is a concern for people of both genders.
These 14 women lost their lives because they were women and because they were engineering students who symbolized the incredible gains being made towards achieving women's equality. In commemorating the Montreal Massacre, we also reflect on the ongoing problems of violence against women in our society and the daily way the lives of women and girls are shaped and affected by men's violence. The challenges we still face in ending violence against women may seem daunting, but we need to draw solace, and even more importantly, encouragement from the commitment of organizations such as Women's College Hospital and from the many people within institutions such as hospitals, the government, the police, the criminal justice system who are working to make positive change. We should be inspired by the dedication of the many thousands of women who have worked on the front lines for decades addressing gender violence. This year, in reflecting on the problem of violence against women, I want to talk about, not about the girls and women, I want to talk about men. So I'm going to address three themes in my talk today. First, why violence against women is really a men's issue. Secondly, what some of the key challenges are in mobilizing men for change to end violence against women. And thirdly, moving forward, why we need global action for men on violence against women. So first, I'm going to speak about violence against women as a men's issue. Following the Montreal Massacre, and even before it happened, many women and some men were working to end rape, domestic violence, and child abuse. Among the most important shifts since the Montreal Massacre has been the beginning of a conversation about understanding violence against women as a men's issue. And Jackson Katz is one of the men who's done some very influential work in this area. I don't know, probably many of you know his work. He's written the book, The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help. And speaking of paradoxes, on the back cover of his book, the publisher has categorized it as a book for women's studies. So one of the main arguments Katz makes is that calling violence against women a woman's issue is actually part of the problem. Katz tells us that framing violence against women as a women's issue gives men an excuse not to pay attention. When rape, wife assault, and sexual harassment are thought of as women's issues, this shifts the responsibility away from the male perpetrators and onto the female victims. The message to men is, as long as you do not assault women yourself, you can ignore the whole thing. So the question Katz poses to us is this: isn't it about time we had a national conversation about the male causes of this violence instead of endlessly lingering on its consequences in the lives of women? So to draw a medical analogy, and I've often used this when I talk about prevention, we wouldn't address a pervasive health problem such as lung cancer by focusing exclusively on what the lungs are like once in a disease. Instead, we would develop theories about what causes the cancer, what can we do about it, and then address those behaviors or environmental factors that contribute to the cancer, and we would definitely be looking at the conditions which allow it to develop. For decades, the conversation, research, and services have been overwhelmingly focused on the victims of rape and child sexual abuse and dealing with the long-term effects on their lives. So what has been noticeably absent is a sustained parallel focus on understanding perpetrators. Who does it to whom? Why does it happen? What contributes to it? What conditions allow these problems to develop? And what can we do to prevent this? The way we conceptualize an issue shapes how we respond to it. In other words, how we define the problem is intimately connected to how we aim to end it and to prevent it. We need to have a causal explanation about what is creating the problem of violence in the first place. So the second reason Katz says that violence against women must be seen as a men's issue is because this violence is overwhelmingly committed by men. We know that most men are not violent. And this needs to be emphasized in the context of the comments I'm making today, so there's not a misunderstanding. But we also know that violence against women is overwhelmingly committed by men. Violence against women is not caused by women, and it won't be stopped by focusing on what women can do to change their lives in response to it. Men's ignorance of this issue of violence against women and men's thinking that it's not their problem is indeed part of the problem. Katz argues that not only are men the primary perpetrators, but he points out that other men are often passive bystanders to violence against women. And what he means by this, if you're a member of a dominant group and you don't speak up when others in your group are abusive, your silence is a form of consent and complicity. In my view, this also applies to silence in other dominant groups on issues such as racism, poverty, and homophobia. So Katz, along with others in the field, are saying men's silence on the issue of violence against women needs to be broken. We need to think about what it would look like if there were sufficient political will to coordinate a massive and widespread violence prevention effort.
That was Dr. Lori Haskell speaking at the Ceremony of Remembrance at the Women's College Hospital in Toronto. It's now time for your Thunderbird Eye on Sports, and for that, we go to Jeff Sargent.
Thank you very much. Well, there was just one Thunderbirds team in conference action over the weekend, meaning the struggling UBC men's hockey team had the spotlight solely on them. Heading into Friday's matchup against the Calgary Dinos, Thunderbirds head coach Milan Dragicevic maintained the team needed to win both games of the weekend series in order to salvage their season. The team certainly responded with a convincing 5-2 win over Calgary, with Tyler Ruel notching a hat-trick, leading UBC to their fifth win of the season. But Saturday night, the Dinos answered back with a 4-1 victory. Brett O'Malley had a pair of goals for the Albertan visitors, while Dustin Butler stopped 22 of 23 UBC shots sent his way. Ruel got his fourth goal of the weekend in the third period, but it was far too late for the Birds, who now fall to 5-10-1 on the year. They're tied with Lethbridge for fifth place in the conference. That's 8 points back of Saskatchewan, who currently holds the fourth and final playoff berth. The loss makes for a very difficult road ahead for the Thunderbirds if they hope to make the postseason come the new year. The team now enters the winter break and returns to conference play January 8th at home to the Regina Cougars for the first of a two-game weekend series. We'll have both for you live on CITR.ca, with Friday's matchup also on the air at 101.9 FM. Saturday's game also marked our last CITR sports broadcast for 2009, as all teams are into exam period and then Christmas break. We'll be back on the air, as mentioned, January 8th with men's hockey, as well as men's and women's basketball, with the Regina Cougars in town Friday and the Brandon Bobcats on Saturday the 9th, as the men's team hopes to keep their number one ranking and perfect season intact, while the women's team hopes to improve upon their respectable 5-3 record. That's your Thunderbird Eye on Sports for this Monday and the last for 2009. From all of us here at CITR Sports, have a very happy holiday season. I'm Jeff Sargent.
And now it's time for a look at your weekday weather forecast. For that, we go to Alice Wang.
Thanks, Megan. Here's your forecast for December 7th to December 11th. It's cold, it's brisk, but it's sunny, and it'll stay that way for this week. Thanks to strong ridge of high pressure over BC, we've got colder Arctic air slowly funneling down from the north, but it's not cold enough to be a major Arctic outbreak. The current air mass is very dry, with humidity hovering around 15% during the daytime hours, which is really low for a maritime climate. Normal daytime highs for this time of the year is usually 7 degrees, but daytime highs this week will hover around 1 to 2 degrees by the water. Monday evening to the overnight, a few clouds with a low of minus 6. Tuesday, sunny, high of plus 1. Wednesday, sunny, high of plus 1. Thursday, sunny, high of plus 1. And Friday, there'll be a mix of sun and cloud, high of plus 2. Currently, it's 0 degrees and mostly cloudy at YVR. That's your weather for this week, brought to you by the Storm Club of UBC. For News 101, I'm Alice Huang.
Thanks, Alice. And that's our show for December 9th. Tune in next Friday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. Stay tuned for Career Fast Track on 101.9 FM, CITR.